We'll go on the record and come to order. The commission is hereby convened in open session on Thursday, December 17th, 2020, to consider the matter entitled Secretary of Labor versus Solar Sources Mining, LLC, docket number LAKE 2017-0099. Present are me, Marco Rakovich, Chair of the Commission, Commissioner Alton, and Commissioner Traynor. For the record, and due to our protocol for continuity of operations for our COVID-19 response, all commissioners and commission counsel are appearing today by means of electronic video and audio. So if any of the participants loses the electronic connection or it gets a little erratic, bring it to our attention. We'll stop the proceedings until we get everybody reconnected. We'll start with an overview of the case presented by Linda Weil. So Linda, you have the floor.
Thank you. Good morning, Chairman and Commissioners. This proceeding is on appeal to the Commission for the second time. Solar Sources Mining, LLC, appeals the judge's remand decision in which he reassessed his penalty assessment after making findings on the Section 110I penalty criteria and more fully explaining the basis for his assessment as directed by the Commission in its initial decision. The facts of the violation involve an accident at Solar Sources Shamrock Surface Mine. On June 29, 2016, a truck driver reversed a truck to dump slurry into an approximately 42-foot pit when the truck unexpectedly over-traveled the safety berm and overturned into the pit. The driver jumped from the cab and narrowly escaped, sustaining broken bones in both legs. MSHA issued order number 9102704 pursuant to section 104D2 of the Mine Act for violating 30 CFR section 77.1605L, which provides berms, bumper blocks, safety hooks, or similar means shall be provided to prevent over-travel and overturning at dumping locations. Solar contested the citation and the judge conducted a hearing. In his initial decision, the judge affirmed the secretary's serious gravity and high negligence findings, and that the violation was significant and substantial and demonstrated the operator's unwarrantable failure. The judge found that a significant penalty was appropriate, as it was based on high negligence, serious gravity, and the fact that Solar knew or should have known the berm construction was inadequate, yet made no efforts to correct the hazardous condition. In a footnote, the judge summarily stated that he had considered the other penalty criteria. He assessed a penalty of $68,300, the same amount proposed by the secretary. Solar appealed the judge's decision, arguing that the judge failed to assess a civil penalty in accordance with the Mine Act and the Commission's guidance in the American Coal Company, and as a result, abused his discretion. On appeal, the Commission vacated the judge's decision and remanded the case back to him to reassess a penalty. The Commission noted that the judge based his penalty determination on only two criteria, negligence and gravity, and failed to make findings on and take into account the impact of the remaining criteria. Specifically, the judge failed to make findings on the operator's violation history and good faith abatement. The Commission directed him to consider the evidence pertaining to these criteria, make findings, and explain their impact, along with the other penalty criteria, on his penalty determination. On remand, the judge, adhering to the Commission's instructions, detailed his analysis for both the good faith and history of violations criteria, and ultimately determined not to reduce the penalty on the basis of these criteria. Regarding its history of violations, he found that Solar had previous berm violations years prior to the current incident, and new berms were a constant problem that required constant attention. He also found that the serious gravity and high negligence outweighed any reduction that its history might have warranted. Addressing good faith, the judge found that no reduction was warranted because Solar's efforts to achieve compliance were merely what MSHA required it to do in order to abate the violation. The judge also found that the operator was large and that the penalties would not affect its ability to continue in business. noting the commission's guidance to judges on special assessments as enhanced penalties. The judge concluded that this violation was especially egregious. He emphasized that the serious gravity and high negligence were the most significant factors in his penalty determination and assessed a new penalty of $69,000. In its second appeal, Solar contends that the judge misapplied the commission's AMCO 1 and Solar Sources 1 decisions in reassessing the penalty. Specifically, with regards to its violation history, Solar argues that the judge erred by considering evidence of citations beyond 15 months over its exemplary 15-month history, by not crediting its low violation history, and failed to examine whether the operator had any recent repeat violations to support an enhanced penalty. Solar argues that the judge erred in not giving it credit for good faith abatement based on his finding that the failed berm could not be abated and the fact that MSHA required it to abate the violation. Solar contends that the judge failed to consider new safety measures it put in place to prevent future incidents. As to the judge's ultimate penalty determination on remand, Solar contends that the judge erred by not requiring the secretary to provide MSHA's special assessment worksheet and failing to take into consideration the penalty that would have been assessed under MSHA's regular assessment formula. It also asserts that the judge's assessment on remand is clear evidence of confirmation bias. It argues that the judge erred by giving high negligence finding the highest weight in assessing a new penalty. Finally, it requests the commission to reassess a new penalty, taking into consideration the appropriate mitigating effect of its violation history and good faith abatement. The secretary responds that Solar's arguments relating to anchoring, document production, and the judge's negligence findings are unfounded or not properly before the commission. He asserts that the judge acted within his discretion by finding that Solar's good faith abatement did not warrant a reduction in the violation penalty. He also argues that the judge properly considered the operator's violation history. The secretary requests that the commission affirm the judge's decision. In reply, Solar argues that the judge abused his discretion in excluding evidence of the regular assessment worksheet. It contends that the secretary misstates its argument on anchoring and continues to argue that the judge inappropriately used the secretary's proposed assessment as a starting point. Solar claims that its argument on the judge's flawed interpretation of high negligence is not barred because the judge modified his negligence finding in his remand decision and thus was properly raised in its PDR. Due to the judge's errors, it suggests that the commission modify the judge's order and exercise its authority to assess a penalty between $15,000 and $25,000. Rule that in special assessment cases, the secretary must produce the regular assessment worksheet, and also rule that the judge may not consider an operator's violation history beyond what the secretary presents in the assessment worksheet or the 15-month regulatory timeframe. If anyone has questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Okay, thank you, Linda. Any questions for Linda?
Linda, I'm sorry to put you on the spot with this one, but I only recently thought about it. Do you know whether in our history the commission has ever set the penalty ourselves rather than remanding to a judge if we find error? Is that something we have done in the past?
We have done it. There was one particular case that I had cited, Rushford Trucking. It was somewhat similar procedurally to this case in that we had the commission remanded the case back to the judge several times. In fact, it remanded the case back to the judge twice. And the underlying issue dealt with the judge's treatment of the penalty criteria. The first go around, he had not made the requisite findings. On the second time, I think he may have modified one of his penalty findings and misapplied the others. And finally, when it was appealed the third time, the commission ultimately assessed the penalty. I meant to go back to look to see if what the penalty amount was compared to what the secretary had proposed. But the judge had assessed a lower penalty and the commission assessed a higher penalty on the third appeal. That case involved a fatality. So that was a key factor in the commission finding the judge's handling of the penalty criteria to be to not be sufficient. I haven't found any other cases. I would have to try to look to see if I can. I know it came up in some settlement cases where the commission approved the penalty, but that's a little different than this.
Right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, Commissioner Traynor has volunteered to speak first, so go ahead, Commissioner Traynor.
Thank you, Chairman. I think the initial decision in this case, though not precedential for having exceeded the scope of the PDR, made a real mess of our case law respecting our review of our judge's assessment of penalties. I would affirm the judge's exercise of discretion on the basis of his explanation that the negligence and gravity factors associated with the violation in this case were of, quote, the highest order, justifying the highest penalty that could be imposed. I agree and would affirm. But of course, I would affirm even if I disagreed, because I think our judges have, and it's important that they have, wide discretion in setting penalties. And I fear that in our recent case law, we've moved from that system. I'm worried that if we cross a line and start setting penalties for ourselves regularly, I understand we've done it before, at least in one instance. If we make a regular practice of that, it'll mark a watershed change in our jurisprudence, and I don't think it would be for the better. We'll have gone really in this one case, in our two decisions in this one case, from a system where we give broad discretion to our judges' application of the six penalty criteria to this new system where political appointees, and that's what we are, decide on the basis of who controls the political majority what the penalties will be and whether they're acceptable. It doesn't take a crystal ball to see how that will work out and to see that it will undermine the consistency and integrity of our decision making. I think the way we review our judges' initial decision with wide abuse of giving them wide discretion and review for abuse of discretion insulates that decision making from the political considerations that come into play when you have political appointees serving terms making those decisions. So I'd close by saying, on this case, I could affirm the judge because the negligence and the gravity alone would support the penalty. But even in a bigger picture, the bigger picture point I'd like to make is that I don't think we're doing our jobs properly if we don't leave our judges the discretion to do theirs. And I think that at some point we're going to have to restore our case law, which affirmed that wide discretion for years and years and years until we departed from that in this case.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Commissioner. Commissioner Austin, your thoughts.
Thank you, Chair Rakovich, and thank you, Commissioner Traynor, for your presentation. And most of all, thank Linda. I thank Linda for her help with me on this case. I asked a number, just as Commissioner Traynor asked questions, I asked a number of similar questions pertaining to the record and our case history, and she got back to me quickly and decisively on all those issues. So I really appreciate both her excellent memo and her help after it. I guess I'd start by saying there's no question, and I don't have to go through the legislative history or our case law, that Congress intended civil penalties, as it had to be for deterrence rather than punishment. On a civil penalty case, you get less due process than I get on a parking ticket. So it has to be for deterrence, not for punishment. It's not because we're mad at the operator, it's because we need to deter that kind of misconduct. So when we come to deterrence, it's a pretty well-established formula used in many statutes, both federal and state. You certainly start with the depriving the defendant of any benefit of its conduct. So that this usually would come up more in a fraud kind of case where they made $1 million by committing fraud. You got to take $1 million away from them. A little harder to see how that really applies in our COAL Act cases, because figuring out what the benefit of a insufficient berm is would be, I think, or other violations would be tricky. But the second element that you start with in determining deterrence is, of course, to address the harm or possible harm resulting from the misconduct. Those are your starting points. I say, however, that I don't think it's that you start at a maximum or you start those points and then see if you can chip away at it. to me, it's a much more holistic process in which, having started with those ideas in mind, you now have to fold into them in a holistic way the other considerations that go into deterrence. And the Mine Act considerations are similar to the considerations set out in many federal statutes. Ability to remain in business is one, irrelevant here. But the size of the business, the history of violations, negligence, and good faith in showing that you're going to comply going forward are all elements of how much should we penalize this person in order to deter the conduct in the future, any similar misconduct in the future. Now, MSHA's regular assessment process essentially does that, because it takes the factors. I think if you look at the scheme, gravity is weighted most heavily. You can get the most points on gravity. Actually, what MSHA does, it takes the factors and breaks them down into sub-factors, so that on gravity, you really have three sub-factors. And gravity is the most, you can get the most points for gravity, so that's harm. You get a lot of points for negligence, which is sort of quasi-harm. And then you also get points moving you up for the other factors. But to the extent that you're good on those other factors, it retards the increase. So MSHA, I think, takes a modified view of this approach on its regular assessment. Its special assessment process, I find that it's very different because for several reasons. One, it doesn't give any guidelines as to when it's going to specially assess. I mean, why this berm violation was specially assessed versus another berm violation where the berm was found to be an unwarrantable failure of the regulation. We go under a regular citation. You know, this is a serious violation, but another berm violation might be serious and not specially assessed. And we, the public and commission, have no idea what the difference is. And that indeed, I think they say that every rule to live by will be evaluated for a special assessment. But there's been no public notice on whether that's a good idea or not. I understand their right to stress certain rules. And so I think that's fair. But again, which rules to live by? How do you violate the rules? So we don't know much about special assessments, and there's really no transparency in that process. So the MSHA formula, it does consider harm first and then all the other factors on the regular formula. The problem with the special assessment formula essentially is that it can tend to read out any consideration of other factors. For example, in this case, they refused to turn over how they did the special assessment. But it's not entirely, for example, the regular assessment's not really mysterious here, because we can look at the regulations and figure out what the regular assessment would have been. I think the only number we don't have is the number of points for controlling. Otherwise, we can come up with it as being essentially back at that time. Remember, the penalties schedule has differed now. The points to the dollar have differed. At that time, it looked to me like it'd be a $15,000 to $20,000 penalty, depending upon the size of the controlling coal company. So we can figure out for ourselves what the regular assessment would have been. The special assessment, if you look, they have a guide to how they apply points to the special assessment, which is a little hard to understand and difficult for a person outside the agency to apply. But just if you look at that guide and apply it to this case, it looks to me like by applying all the extra penalties, and they only consider negligence, and they add penalties for negligence and gravity. And it looks to me like they would have got the penalty so high that you couldn't possibly get below a maximum penalty, no matter what how much good faith you showed and so forth. So they seem to read in the special assessment process, those factors on deterrence can be read out of the statute. Now, here the judge continues to make, unfortunately, my opinion, and he's a fine judge, and people can differ on this. So I'm just saying that, you know, we're paid to give our opinion. So in my opinion, he made many, many mistakes. He went immediately, essentially to the maximum. 70 may have been the maximum. He went to 69. And as Commissioner Traynor says, he sort of looked at it as, well, have you done anything to reduce the maximum here? And he says, no. Again, my approach would not be to go immediately to the maximum and then look at other factors and see, well, can we get it down from the maximum? And he doesn't even, his findings aren't really even at the maximum level on the penalty factor. So he finds high negligence, but the maximum level of negligence is reckless disregard. The actual event he finds, oddly enough, in the citation, and then I guess sustained by the judge, the inspector found it reasonably likely to cause a fatality, which changes, again, how the penalty formula is applied. The actual event was lost work days occurred. So again, he goes to the maximum penalty, but even on gravity, he doesn't find the maximum gravity. So he doesn't find either the maximum gravity or the maximum negligence, but he goes to the maximum penalty. I'm not saying that's impossible or necessarily wrong, but it's a factor. He brushed aside the factors of the history of violations, and the two berm violations. I'll turn first to then going forward, good faith. The judge said, quote, the respondent displayed zero good faith as that term is described among the statutory penalty factors, close quote. That statement is completely and absolutely wrong as a matter of law and as a matter of fact. First, and in fact, I think it's really inimical to deterrence consideration. I think the judge also, I'll get to it, he displayed a retributive desire here rather than a deterrence desire. So it's a cast of mind by the judge. The judge said the questions about improvements in dumping were irrelevant on transcript page 347. Then he said, somewhat sarcastically, and unfortunately sarcastically, transcript 349, question, but basically what you've done, Mr. Atkinson, you all have designed a system that now prevents what happened here of a berm collapse from occurring. Answer, yeah. Judge Moran, or you hope so. Sarcasm shows a cast of mind. But more importantly, MSHA's penalty regs say you can get a 10% reduction in the penalty amount of the regular assessment where the operator abates the violation within time set by the inspector. That's not what the law says. The law says the demonstrated good faith of the person charged in attempting to achieve rapid compliance after notification of violation. So it's not confined to abating the violation. It's showing that the operator is going to rapidly come into compliance with the law, and it speaks to terms of compliance, not abatement. So while I credit MSHA for taking that into account, but the way they've done it in the regulations doesn't reach the full level of deterrence through good efforts. I looked around to other agencies to see how they've handled deterrence, did a little reading on deterrence versus punishment. Of course, it's very hard sometimes to determine whether you're deterring or punishing. But another commissioner on another commission recently said, quote, if our goal is to make compliance more attractive than violation, we also should consider the cost and effect of the other sanctions imposed in the context of an enforcement action. These effects include the cost and constraints of complying with the injunction, the fencing in of otherwise legal conduct. All of these non-monetary sanctions can have substantial deterrence effect on violative behavior. I believe that deterrence comes first. So the thought that you don't take into account the fact that they had to go through a system to make all their berms more secure, spend money doing that has no relevance to the penalty. It's just wrong. They had to spend a lot of money to come into compliance, whether it was voluntary or involuntary, they spent a lot of money to come into compliance, and all that goes to whether this violation and what they've had to do, both civil penalty and performance, deters further misconduct. The judge found good faith was not applicable because the berm was gone when they got there, so there was nothing they could do to abate it. That is just clearly wrong. The judge erred on both points. Also, it does not, there's a, it's just an error to not take into account the good faith of the operator in achieving compliance and spending money to make sure the berms are good going forward. That goes to deterrence, which is the point of the civil penalty. Now we get to their prior history. They have a good history. 19 violations in the last 15 months with less than $14,000. And then the judge puts a lot of weight, incredible weight, on two berm violations 6 and 8 years before. Now, those berm violations, no citations were entered to record. There's really no evidence regarding those berm violations, what they were, how serious, what the penalty was, anything. It comes from one of the operator's witnesses being asked, have you had berm violations in the past? And I can almost see him scratching his head. And it basically says, I think we had them back. I think we had one back in 2008. And I think we had one in 2000. And he actually said in 2010, 11, or 12. So uncertain, even that the berm violations occurred, no record of them in the, and yet the judge says, by gosh, we've got these berm violations, and that shows that we've got these berm violations 6 years ago, and that I'm not giving them any credit for good history. And again, he speaks in terms of whether the history should warrant a deduction. And again, it's holistic, it's a holistic thing. It makes it clear that the operator would have received only 2 points. In this case, the operator would have received only 2 points for its prior history, showing that it's actually a very, on a scale of 2 to 10 or 15, whatever it is, showing it had a good record, and no history that would have been credited to points on specific violations of the berm. And so its history is good. And that is a factor that needs to be taken into account in setting a deterrence penalty. And there's no history of significant unworkable failures in the past. So if I get to it, I summarize the errors. The judge highlighted two old violations, and to say that they're not really ancient, 6 years ago is not the Roman Colosseum, but we don't know what's happened at the company in that period. And so to say, I'm going to take a violation, an uncertain violation of uncertain status from 6 years ago, and that means their prior history is meaningless. That makes no sense to me. I mean, I appreciate the judge and his desire here to get a good penalty, but that's just not what deterrence looks like. He failed to give any credit for being better than an average operator. No credit for no violations of 77, 1605 in the last two years. Total penalties of less than $14,000 over 2 years. Again, he doesn't give him any credit for the costly changes to the berm, and he used these unproven violations to bolster the penalty. So given all this, in my mind, despite his best efforts, the judge didn't reach the consideration of deterrence that we need to give, and that the judges should give. And then to the last point what deference we should give the judges. I think we can give the judge very strong deference. I think looking at whether a judge has abused his or her discretion in setting a penalty is a good policy way to look at it. I think we should, as a matter of policy, defer greatly to the judges on this. But that's not the law. The law must be that we have the right to review de novo penalty assessments. I don't want to review penalty assessments. I don't want operators coming up here or the secretary, it works both ways, coming up here and say, well, the penalty's wrong. We should stay out of that business too. We should stay out of that business. But when push comes to shove, the Mine Act says the commission sets the penalty. We have the right to set the penalty, and we would have to do it based upon facts found by the judge on substantial evidence. So if we come to set the penalty here, the facts found by the judge, high negligence, the grievousness of the violation, all those facts have to be taken into account. We, can't second guess negligence, can't second guess gravity. His factual findings can't be second guessed. But in terms of the policy decision, the legal decision of what penalty should be assessed, we have an absolute right to make that determination. I would look at it, so I'm trying to draw a distinction here between as a matter of policy, saying it's very rare we'll look at that, versus a matter of law as to our right to look at it. And it makes a difference because if what we do goes to a court of appeals, the court of appeals should be viewing our penalty for an abuse of discretion, not reviewing whether we erred in reversing the judge for abuse of discretion by a judge. The law is extraordinarily clear that we set the penalty, and the commission, a circuit court, should be reviewing what we did, not what the judge did, and what we did with what the judge did. So I don't want to get into all of that, but I mean, I do think the law needs to be clear that the law is that we set the penalty. But our policy should be to defer greatly to our excellent judges and their experience. I have to quickly say, I was a little, I confess here, I'm a Republican, and was appointed first by a Democratic president and then by a Republican president. I don't look at myself as a political actor here. I come with an entire record of what I've done in my life, but the thought that I am somehow carrying out a political mandate or that our decisions are based upon politics, I just reject that. I think when we got to the Newtown case, which established a good standard for SNS, that was in political terms, bipartisan decision. Republican and Democratic commissioners came together to set a good standard. So I don't think in political terms, and I don't think any of the commissioners should. So what should we do? I think here it's just unfair to the judge and futile to send this back to him for a review. I honestly think that it's unfair to him in a way to say, well, you didn't look at this, you didn't look at this, you didn't look at this, even though he's made his point of view entirely clear, and say, well, now set a penalty. Because basically what we're saying is you got to lower the penalty, judge. But he doesn't want to lower the penalty. So it seems to me entirely futile to lower the penalty. And I'm not saying we'll end up necessarily lowering the penalty, although as I look at the factors, it's obvious from what I've said that I would, because negligence doesn't reach the maximum. Gravity doesn't reach the maximum. They have a good record on safety, on inspection history, and they have a good record on coming into compliance with the law and deterring any future berm violations. So I would prefer us to just go ahead and set the penalty. To be honest, as I always would be in these meetings, I have a figure in mind, and it's based upon my evaluation of the harm, benefit to the extent it can be evaluated, benefit and harm in the context of all these other factors. And so I know what I would do weighing those. But I think it's very unfair to me to throw out, it'd be terrible to throw out a number here in the open here, because whatever I said would be if the chairman wants to remand, Commissioner Traynor wants to remand, then I would have said what I think the penalty should. So I will not put out a penalty amount here, but I certainly would set one by going through the exercise I've described. I'd look at the harm as found by the judge, including the grievances of the harm, as found by the judge, which he thinks is warranting of a higher than a IMSHA penalty assessment, regular penalty assessment. And then I would look at all these other factors, which I think the judge has not weighed properly, and come up with a penalty. And so I last night I sat down and did all my formulas, did all my weighing, gave weight to different factors and all, and I have a penalty in my mind, but I'm not gonna say it. That's it for me.
Okay, well, thanks, Commissioner Alton. And again, Linda, very well written, thorough analysis, and is very helpful to me. Very excellent analysis. In our remand of this case, we directed the judge to make findings effect, or meaningful explanation on each of these statutory penalty criteria. And in particular, in this case, we keyed in on the findings regarding the operator's history violations. And we also requested findings on the operator's actions related to the attempt to achieve rapid compliance after notification of the violation. And we also cited AMCO 2 on our concern about unconscious effect of anchoring as related to the Secretary's proposed assessment figure. Since the Secretary here originally proposed $68,300 and the judge ultimately assessed the same penalty figure, $68,300. And the concern in anchoring, obviously, is there's got to be a separation between the Commission and the Secretary. And as the way I see it, I don't want there to be any room for any inferences at all that the Commission is just rubber stamping the Secretary's assessment proposals. As we pointed out in that decision, the portion of the Secretary's special assessment narrative form is used to derive the amount of the penalty proposal was not in this record. And we noted then in AMCO 1, that document was provided to the operator in that particular case. I see that as evidence as to other penalty considerations, other than just one penalty consideration. So now we've got the case again, and the judge assessed a new penalty of $69,000. After the remand, the judge did request additional information to the parties, but that special assessment worksheet was not requested by the judge, despite the specific mention here in our decision. The request by the operator for production of that sheet was denied. So from the judge's decision, criteria that went into what a regular assessment was calculated to be was not considered, even though the original assessment figure of $68,300 was obviously considered. That's a problem to me. And again, the Commission should never leave any room for inference that it doesn't want to consider all the evidence that's out there. In that original decision, the judge, and we've discussed this, had found high negligence. The operator didn't challenge that finding, but in this remand decision, the judge stated the negligence was of, quote, the highest order. And he added that the points should be based upon the highest penalty that the court could impose. Well, the highest order of negligence that we consider is reckless disregard. And the negligence level in this case was not an issue on appeal. So to me, that's another problem. The law of the case here is that the negligence was already determined as high negligence, not the highest, and not reckless disregard. On the history of violations, the judge based his penalty, and again, we talked about this, on two citations, one that was 6 years prior, one it was 8 years prior. Now, no evidence that I can see in the record was introduced as to the facts of either of these, other than I think what Commissioner Alton mentioned, the mention of that from a witness on the witness stand. I didn't see anything that went into what these two citations were about, the relevance, whatever. I see a real due process concern there in considering these. Now, they were both outside the 15-month prior history that was actually proffered by the Secretary. Excuse me. Our case law precedents, ALJs routinely use a 15-month time frame, and none have gone beyond 2 years. Even this judge's own past cases don't go beyond 2 years of citation history. Now, my problem there was there's no explanation here for the deviation for this case, and there's no explanation for ignoring the compliance record here from 6 years forward as to from the date of that last citation that he used until the date of the citation is issued. Now, to me, that throws in a lot of complications. You know, one of them is, well, how far back should a violation history be considered? That prompts another problem then is, it's a twofold thing. It goes either way. First of all, should credit be given for subsequent good compliance records toward correcting a bad history? And by the same token, should enhanced penalties be imposed for an operator deviating from what was a good history into a now bad one? Now, there's no discussion of that here in this decision. and they reached back going 8 years to consider those two citations. So here the judge apparently gave greater weight to those two citations, again going back 8 years, than he gave to the operator's history in the last 15 months without analyzing any kind of evidence there of these two citations or analyzing the recent history of compliance. The judge also said that these two citations put the operator on notice. Now, notice is not a component here. I mean, notice is a component of the unwarrantable failure designation, but that's not on appeal here. And there was no analysis of how this notice is even relevant to the history of violations criterion. Another point, the judge issued a directed verdict on an on-shift examination citation. In the remand decision, he stated that if the secretary had moved to amend, he would have granted that amendment. And then he implies that there were other prior inadequate examinations to justify this penalty assessment. Well, again, I've got some serious due process concerns there, and that's not a proper basis for an assessment. We specifically wanted review of the operator's actions as they related to rapid compliance here on notification after notification of the violation. Now, I agree that abatement is always mandated. But to me, the real question here is whether the operator went beyond that requirement in good faith to do more. Now, here's what's a little puzzling to me. In the initial decision, the judge found the operator's post-incident action was laudable, his words. And he added that it was reflective of a serious attitude that the operator takes towards safety. Now, it looks plain to me that the judge in the first decision was complimenting the operator on the post-incident action. Then in this remand decision, the judge says the operator, as Commissioner Alton said, had zero good faith. Now, my concern here is there's no explanation for the inconsistency here between his initial comments in the initial decision and these latest comments. Now, he mentioned that the berm had vanished and rapid compliance was not available. But the fact that the berm was destroyed doesn't mean that the operator couldn't abate that violation. And in fact, it did abate the violation. I didn't see any evidence there that the operator failed to quickly rectify that condition. I didn't see any evidence that it initially refused to abate that violation. But instead of rebuilding the berm, the evidence shows that they worked with MSHA to modify for a new method of dumping. Now that to me is inconsistent with zero good faith in attempting to achieve compliance here. So looking at all of this together, you know, we remanded this case for specific findings. In response to that remand, the judge requested information from the parties. We noted the significance of this assessment form criteria that was not requested by the judge, and the request for inclusion was denied. The judge said the penalty was set, you know, considering the highest order of negligence instead of actually keying in on the negligence level that was actually found and uncontested here. There was considerations of allegations of inadequate examinations, one of which was vacated by the judge. The others were never charged. And I believe there's a misunderstanding of the law here on considerations of efforts to abate a citation. So all of this together raises another concern of anchoring to one proposed figure assessment here. So I do see an abuse of discretion here leading me to reverse the judge's decision. So now what? This is the second appeal here of this case. A remand is not, to me, the most efficient use of time and resources under these circumstances. Now, Linda mentioned in response to Commissioner Traynor's question there about a case, Rushford Trucking. Now, that was in 2002, but now Rushford was based upon two other cases, Westmoreland and Steen, that go back, Westmoreland goes back to 86, Steen goes back to 98. So I think there's good guidance here for us considering this second appeal. So what I would do from this point is I would review this record and then I would set the appropriate penalty. So now at that point, I'll open it up to further discussion here.
Chairman, how do you suggest we go about setting that appropriate penalty? Because it seems inappropriate for us to start kicking around things here and so forth. Doesn't seem the
yeah, right policy. Let me tell you what I've got in my mind to do. I mean, as you say, and again, Commissioner Traynor, I am not saying we usurp the power of these judges. What I'm saying is they've made findings there. They made fact findings. What I'm saying is this is the second go around here, and I still see errors in this thing. But I tell you what I'm thinking about. There were certain findings there that I think stand, that go into this penalty calculation. So that to me is are the things that my own personal self, what I'm going to look at, is I'll take those. And whatever figure that was, as far as those goes, what I'm really keen in on is the very thing that we sent this thing back for, is should there be some consideration of these other two factors here, the compliance factor, the history factor? And I think there should be. So to me, that's where I think that I'm heading, is I want to try to figure out, and I think we can, is to figure out what, because if you think about it, if the thing went back on remand, the judge would have to use the same record that we're using. If it went to a different judge, they're going to use the same record here that we're working. They could request more information, this, that, and the other. We've got it all there. So that's kind of what I intend to do, is look at it from that standpoint and then come up with an appropriate penalty.
I'll use the word naive to think that this won't prompt future litigants to forum shop a penalty decision. If we regularly intervene and fly spec these decisions and don't give wide deference to the judge, to our judges, and that's not, by the way, a question of policy, it is a question of law. It's our established case law says we give wide discretion. The APA and the way it's set up for our review of our judges' decisions is intended to give us wide discretion, or give the judges wide discretion. And so we're not following the law if we don't afford that discretion. And I think that if we break that wall by taking this decision away from our judges, in this case, even though it's been done before, it's been a while, it's been rare, and if we do that, we're only inviting parties to go to the commission to get a result that they would prefer to the result they got from the judge, if they know that they can come to us for a reassessment rather than a remand. And I, even if you agree, even if you say, all right, well, on balance, I still want to do it, I'd ask you to acknowledge that fact. I mean, I know Commissioner Alton doesn't, but I'd ask you to think about whether there will be a political motivation. Let's not call it political, because I think there's a confusion. Some people think that means partisan politics. It's not about that.
What did it mean?
I think that the parties have an expectation. The parties may have an expectation of getting a lower penalty from one commission as compared to if they're looking at the makeup, a different makeup of a different commission, they may look for a different result. And, I don't think it's beyond reason to acknowledge that that's what's likely to happen, that it will happen. And so right now, the system we have insulates the decision maker. And we're reviewing in a system that gives wide discretion, but that person retains the decision about what penalty is to be assessed, which isn't a mathematical calculation. We've continuously rejected any notion that we're doing the Part 100 calculations that we spent a lot of time at this meeting going through. We've held that whether it's specially assessed or regularly assessed shouldn't have a bearing because the judges are setting a penalty independently. So I don't know why we spend so much time talking about this stuff. And when our judges then go and set a penalty independently, addressing each of the factors, we should give them wide discretion to do so. And if we don't, and if we completely take that role from them, there will be consequences beyond this case. And I think it's naive to pretend otherwise.
I appreciate that. I completely understand it, and I appreciate it. I even appreciate, of course, looking at different constructions of the commission, a person might anticipate a different result. even on outcome, substantive outcomes. I mean, you look at the way commissions have been ruling, you see different possible substantive outcomes. I think in a sense, though, that the same applies probably even more so with respect to judges. I mean, very honestly, I think you could say, what judge did I draw? Is my penalty going to go up, down? I mean, it depends. The judges have a pattern as to what they do with cases. And any decent lawyer who practices a lot knows when they get the judge assigned to the case, there's some level of different expectation with respect to handling a case. So that's endemic.
I agree with that. We can continue.
I'd also say we should stress that this is entirely unusual. We do not want you coming here with asking us to review penalty assessments. We defer to the judges greatly. There's no question we don't want these things because we're not really equipped to do it very well. We don't have a formula. As a matter of fact, as the commission changes, that formula for how we assess penalties would probably change too, because my formula might be different than your formula, you know, and that sort of thing. So I completely agree. This should be very, very rare. And we should make it clear in a decision where we set the penalty that it's very rare. And it's only because of the particular circumstances of this case that for the first time in X number of years, we're going to set the penalty. So I'm 100% on board with Commissioner Traynor's objective and all of his policy reasons there. I do disagree with him. I don't disagree that we have law, several cases where we say we review the judge's decisions on an abuse of discretion standard. We have those cases. Osric is de novo, and as I think of it, I don't know why they said that in those cases.
You have been charged $349.99 on your Visa card.
Oh, man, I'm getting a spam call saying I got to pay $349.
Your bill collector bill.
Marco, can I hit you up for a little loan, $350? I need $300.
Wait a minute, you cut out on me there. Say that again.
This phone is supposed to be off. Shut up. Anyway, if $349 was my actual Visa card bill for Christmas, I would be delighted. But I'm right on board with Commissioner Traynor with respect that we don't want to see these things. But I guess I just asked Commissioner Traynor, this is a legitimate debate. Do you think if our penalty assessment goes to the Court of Appeals, it should be looking as to whether we've erred in finding the judge abused his discretion or whether we've erred in the penalty we set?
Whether we've erred in applying our abuse of discretion standard.
Yeah, and it's, okay, that makes sense with what you, but I just think the law says the commission shall set the penalty. I can't get past this plain, unequivocal language of the law.
But the way we've done that is by having the judges do that and reviewing it under an abuse of discretion standard. And as long as we do it that way, that's how the court will review it, whether we applied that standard correctly.
Maybe we need to
sets the standard, and therefore, maybe this is the point you're making, that the commission sets the penalty, therefore we have the right to do it, the legal right to do it de novo. As I understand what you're saying.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
It's not what we do, and it's not what we've done for 30 years.
Well, see, it won't go any good to go on here because I think you just said correctly, we have the legal right to do it de novo.
No, I said that's your
position. We've established a policy of not doing it de novo, but we can, if we wish, do it de novo. But we don't need to debate it. We don't need to debate that here. But, I would go along with the chair and set the penalty here with no disrespect whatsoever for this excellent judge. And gosh, he writes very good, insightful, well-considered opinions. He's a novel writer. He writes very well. He thinks well. I mean, everything's good, except in this case, I don't think he took, I think some of his remarks too seem to me to touch upon more of a retributive view than a deterrent view. And I think we need to keep deterrence in our mind as the function, and therefore you need to look at these other factors. So I'm not critical of the judge. I just think it's unfair to him to ask him to do something that's not in his mindset in the case, and we should just go ahead and do it.
May I respond just to 2 points?
Yeah, sure.
I view it as a positive development that my colleagues recognize that it's important in this decision that majority decision that may be drafted, that we state that this is unusual that we would take from our judge the role of setting a penalty. Unfortunately, I think I know as a litigant, as a former litigant, a litigator, that you look at what the court does, not what it says. And so it's what we do that matters. It's what we do that sets the law. We can say all we want about how, look, this is unusual, but here we are doing it. It's going to invite more of that. And so I think we should really rethink whether we do it at all. I understand we don't have to beat a dead horse. I understand we disagree on that. With respect to the point about judges having particular tendencies, maybe litigants have noticed some judges may have a tendency to set a higher penalty than another. I don't know that to be the case, but I don't doubt it either. And the point here is when a litigator or a party draws a particular judge, they're stuck with that judge. That judge is who's going to set that penalty. And they don't have the ability to forum shop, to go through the motions with the judge, knowing they can appeal to the committee and get essentially to the commission and get essentially de novo review without any wide deference to discretion. And so the whole idea in the federal courts of containing forum shopping is sticking. It's not, the idea isn't that every judge is perfectly neutral and is going to decide cases exactly the same way. The idea is you get stuck with who you draw so that you avoid gamesmanship. So I just wanted to make that nuanced distinction between a concern about tendencies and the point I'm making about keeping the decision-making with one actor at one level of this system, the way we have for 30 years, the way our law says we do right now. You understand the point. I don't disagree with what you're saying, but I don't think it really answers the concern.
Well, I mean, I don't know. Forum shopping, I guess you've never been I've been in proceedings where you got lawyers from different interests stationed at different courts of appeals around the country.
I was there
on the phone waiting to hear that they issued the regulations so you can get the court you want.
It should be
so forum shopping. We lawyers are just stinking old forum shoppers. And I guess what you're saying is that if they think they've got a hard-nosed commission, the secretary may say, that penalty was too low, I'm taking it up. And you got a light-nosed commission, the operator say, I think they got a penalty, I'm taking it up.
We would encourage that.
We don't want that. I honestly think we've done it before. I forget what Linda said that case was. It's been 15 years since we've done it. I would envision it 20 years before a case came up. So I think, I know what you're saying is we can say whatever we want. And, you know, it's sort of like a parent. They can say whatever they want to their kid, but the parent kid's looking at what they actually do. I think we can make it clear we don't want to review these penalties. I don't want to review these penalties. You know, I lay awake in the middle of the night last night trying to think of a proper formula for coming up how you arrive at deterrent last night. If you think I'd ever want to do that again, no.
Well, Bill, it's not your job, so you don't have to.
Unfortunately, Art, it is my job. That's the problem. It is my job. I'm an old man, and I got lay awake at night thinking about this stuff. Anyway, good job, Art. I completely understand and agree with 98% of what you said.
Well, I'm glad we were able to share our differing points of view.
Yeah. And Commissioner Traynor, let me reinforce something. Let me tell you what I'm not doing. I hope this allays your fears, but not just the fears of everybody here, right here in this commission, but I have no intention of any kind of sea change here on how we do these things with penalties. That is not my intention. Here's where I'm coming from. And I take that to the absurd. I mean, certainly, as Commissioner Alton pointed out, and as the statute says, you know, the penalties are set by the commission. I mean, the authority is there. Now, put that aside for a minute. We three don't want to go out here and start trying cases on a daily basis. I mean, that's really what we're saying that we could do, right? I mean, that's what Congress said is envisioned. We have delegated that and have a whole excellent pool of administrative law judges to do that. And that's our system. I don't see that changing. I'm not advocating that to change. I guess what I'm saying is there comes a point And I did agonize over this as to what to do with this case. There comes a point where I think the old saying goes, the buck stops here. And I think that's what it was with this particular case. And I don't see this as something that we're going to do on a regular basis. But in this particular case, I know we all saw errors the first time. All right. And to his credit, the judge corrected a lot of those. I still see errors. Now, I'm looking at this from more of an efficiency standpoint. I'm like, all right, well, what do we do now? All right, do we send this thing back again? But from the errors that I see, which I really am concerned with, some of these errors, do we send that back again? You know, this specter of the anchoring thing, I'm not saying there was or whatever. I'm saying the inference, I don't like that inference, period. And I want to eliminate that inference altogether. My concern on this case is, essentially, that's what I said. The buck stops here. We're at a point where I think it has to be reversed. So, like, well, what do we do with it? And that's where I'm saying is the efficiency of this thing does not seem clear to me to send this thing back again. Let's go through these things. Here it is. When we've already said, or at least majority, we pointed out some things here that we think needs to be addressed. And my deal is, from just a pure standpoint of that efficiency, let's do it. I mean, we had the authority to do it, so let's do it. But I do agree, and I'm not adverse at all to putting anything in this opinion here, not to say, oh, well, this is an aberration and we shouldn't do that. But I'm all for game is to say, look, you know, we're going by what we've always gone by. But there are times when it does fall that we got to make a decision. And like I said, they did, I think, Westmoreland and Steen, it was 86 and 98. Now, I can't find anything since that time other than Rushford Truck in there in 2002. It's rare. I think it ought to stay that way. Because, again, if we go down that path, like I said, me, you, and Bill don't know to be hopping a plane here and trying cases all over the place. So that's the ultimate of it. So that's where I'm coming from. I understand your concern. I agree with your concern. Is the foreign shopping deal, I think that goes on all the time, no matter what we're going to do. And you're right. I mean, if this situation is construed to say, let's form shop to go to the commission and get a better deal here. But I'm hoping on the integrity here of what we always do, because we have done this. I think we've affirmed these decisions in the past. We haven't delved into penalties unless we thought we needed to. That's where I'm coming from. Mm-hmm. When I think I need to, and that's what I see in this case. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, thank you. I was interrupting you, and I think about this, you know, a few years from now, two other sweater wearing guys are in, you know, a total of five windows here. And I'm upset that a judge has not applied our law, looking at deterrence as a factor sufficiently to set a penalty that I believe is so low, it doesn't meet the purposes of the act. And I remand to the judge, and the judge comes back and tells me to basically stick it in my eye and reduces the penalty by about $100 further, right? Okay. Going through with some different analysis. I'd be upset. And so I understand the impulse to say that's enough. In that situation, I'm certain that the impulse would be strong on my part to try to form a majority, to revisit that decision, take the decision from the judge, and assess the penalty that we think at our level will be sufficient to deter this type of conduct and serve the purposes of the act. And when it comes time to decide whether three sweater guys are going to make that decision, well, two suit guys dissent. Excuse me for being cute with the apparel. Then we're going to, when we're deciding whether or not to do that, we're going to look back at this particular case and say, well, what was done here? And that's the decision we haven't made yet. Is this something we do or is it not? Right. And I know that there'll be arguments about how this case was different, is distinguishable because these factors were at issue. But of course, that future commission may put greater weight on other factors. And so there's always going to be in these multi-factor tests, multiple different ways of looking at the thing. There's multiple different routes for getting under a decision you don't like and finding error. If you push hard enough and if you make somebody jump through enough hoops, eventually they're going to misstep. And so you can find it. The question is, do we defer to it to some reasonable degree or not? And what we do here today will set the pattern, will set a precedent as to what will happen in the future. And that decision in the future, the reasons that will be cited by that future commission for taking the decision away from the judge may be reasons that you all don't agree with. And you might be thinking, dang, it was probably a better system where we let the judges just do this and keep those concerns at that level. Not that at that level, the decision-making is more or less impartial. I agree with Bill's point earlier, but it's contained. And there's a system that contains that decision-making. So you get some kind of finality, and we exist to review only whether the judge has exceeded the outer bounds of reasonableness, not whether we agree with every conclusion they've made or whether we can find error, no matter how small or no matter on what factors that weren't necessarily the driving force behind the penalty, et cetera, et cetera. There's always a route to do it. The question is, do we do it? And I think it's less about what we say and more about what we do in this case. But I'm glad that if a majority here decides to do it, that something is said. But I know as somebody in the future who will be reading our case, well, there's going to be, it's a black or white question. Did we do it or didn't we? Is there a precedent for doing this or isn't there? And I think I'm going to beat a dead horse. I've made the point as clearly as I can. I continue to have the concern. I understand what y'all are doing. I just don't know if it's the best decision. I don't think it's one I would join.
Understood.
I want to say just two quick things and then shut up. First of all, in response to what Commissioner Traynor just said on his hypothetical case in the future, when he's looking at that, if he thinks the judge abused his discretion in lowering the penalty, I think he'll reverse it. And I don't know that he'll keep sending it back and a back and a back until he thinks he hasn't abused his discretion. So I'm not sure you want to make a commitment to not invoke abuse of discretion to reverse a judge's penalty assessment. That's the basis I'm going on here. I'm going on our policy. I'm trying to distinguish. I find the judge abused his discretion by not properly applying the penalty factor. So that's the basis that I would, and I think that's essentially uncurable at this point. So that's the basis I go on. I raise this other thing only as a matter of future discussion. So it's an abuse of discretion situation in my mind here. Secondly, just because we're on a public record here, the people who are listening in, somebody said to me, their name, when I suggested to them that maybe we need to set the penalty, he said, what are you going to do? Just pick a number out of the air? And that is not, at least my intention, as I say, I think we have got to go through, because we don't have a formula like MSHA has, we really have to carefully weigh all the factors and get at a penalty that we think is the appropriate deterrence amount here by according greater weight to harm based upon what the judge, I mean, harm, deprivation of benefit and harm are the first things to come up in a civil penalty for deterrence. But then you leaven that, I'd say, as I don't think you reduce it, you leaven that to me by these other factors as to how much you really need to deter this actor. I saw a Federal Trade Commission decision recently, because I'm trying to do some research on this. Believe it or not, I sometimes research these things before I give an opinion. And where there was a split among those commissioners, where one said, look, there's no harm here. It actually was reversed. The commissioner said, why are we giving them a high penalty here? Because there really was very little harm done here. And the other commissioner saying, but look at their record, look at the way they've acted. These people need to be, you know. So I think I know Chairman Rinkovich will make a conscious weighing of factors and not just pick a number out of the air. So I alleviate anybody who's listening is concerned that we're just going to put a bunch of numbers in a hat and draw one out.
And let me add one thing. Again, we're not beating this dead horse, but I'll put it this way. When we come down for this, when we come down for this decision, I know, you know, how we do this thing. We'll come up with one. I'm sure there's going to be a dissent here, but here's what I would say, Art. Certainly, when you come up with your preliminary dissent, I'm I, for one, am certainly going to read that, because my goal here is, I know there probably will be things we fundamentally disagree with on this thing, all right? And those are there. But my goal is, so we don't get into what you're talking about, some of the extraneous long-term damage here, I'm certainly open to seeing what you've read there and try to at least temper back this majority opinion to where you don't have to say it. I'll put it that way. In other words, let's work on something, I think, to where we can all live with, because I agree with you. Again, this is not a sea change that I'm envisioning. I'm seeing this thing here, and seriously, just from the efficiency of the whole matter, I don't see remanding it. I don't, because, I mean, we're going back into that whole situation again. And I think what you're saying is that the decision as it stands is fine. I respect that, all right? But I don't see this as something where we're saying, well, I don't even care what the judge says, or I don't care about these findings. I'm going to take it on my own. That's not my intention. And I'm committed to writing an opinion here that reflects that too. I'll put it that way. So for what it's worth.
That's good. I appreciate that. And I also want to say that though I was arguing the other case, I don't disregard your appeals to efficiency as legitimate. I understand the thing's been down, it's come back, I will write the dissent with the hope that we can share an even deeper understanding of our respective positions here. My exactly. concern is, and I think in writing, we often are able to get, it's of course, these ideas are all much more clear when we have time to put them in writing. My concern, though, again, is that there won't be anything we can say because it's more fundamentally about what we do. Right. But I don't mean to throw cold water on the endeavor. I think it's still worth trying. I don't know whether there would be anything we could say that would speak more loudly than what we're actually doing. And of course, we have to go back to the decision, the original decision in this case, in my dissent, for my arguments as to why I don't believe we are even engaging in abuse of discretion review anymore. But we certainly don't need to revisit that here, but it's sort of relevant to how I look at the case and the way it's progressed.
Understood.
So that's all.
Okay. Well, it sounds like, and again, Linda, maybe you can pop visually up here again now, because I think this is and again, Linda, excellent memo, because I think all the points that you pro and con that you put into this whole thing, obviously I used, all right, and I'm just from hearing the others, I'm sure they used too, but it sounds to me like we've got a majority that would reverse and set the penalty. We're going to have a dissent. So, we want to work through this thing too, with a goal in mind of just what we said. This is not some kind of, I keep using that buzzword, sea change here, that we're changing everything. Here's a case where this is what we're going to do with it. And in other words, take it for what it is. And again, I understand Art's concern here too, but having said all of that, do you have enough to go on now with putting this thing together?
I think so. I think Rush for Trucking sets a good model for how to address this as an unusual circumstance that's being taken by the commission, that there are exceptional circumstances where the commission has chosen to exercise its authority in this area, and that's what's being done here, and highlight that. So there are certainly enough facts to support. So.
I thought Linda, I thought your memo to us was a masterpiece of satisfying everybody.
Linda, I neglected to thank you, but I agree with my colleagues. It's the one thing we all agree on.
There you go. Right.
It was a very balanced and well-written.
You're my lawyers, anticipating the views. You said, Commissioner Traynor could be right. That, you got a lot of points going for him. Oh, but the other guys could be right, too.
I didn't get that paid.
For them. I don't know. On balance, I can't decide. You could just use your memo to write this. To just cut out all the Commissioner Traynor might be right stuff. And
forward it to me for my dissent, please.
Or to write his dissent too. It's just split your memo in half and you've got an opinion and a dissent. Except we'll have to give you a number.
Yes.
We will have to work on that. And I have
your thoughts,
Your
thoughts on how to formulate the number, in other words, the weight to be given and taking everything into account, because we want to do this in a thoughtful, you know, sort of formulaic way, even though we're not going to lay out, or don't worry, we're not going to lay out a formula for first
future commission. 100, Bill.
Future commission. We're going to set out maybe a point system. Anyway, we're not going to lay out a formula, but we internally need to have a formula in our mind where we've weighed these things properly. So penalty.
The criteria is there. We all know it. All right. Criteria is there. But seriously, Linda, I would charge you to take that criteria there as applied to this particular case. And again, I'm using the findings of what the judge has found. I mean, I'm not trying to disturb that in any way. But do that, and seriously, give us your thoughts, your guidance as applied to this case of what you think here.
I'll take a crack at it.
Too bad we're not in an office where we can just walk into offices and talk to each other. It's so much easier than this silly telework.
Well, I'm a phone call or email away. So,
but Bill, you're not in a hospital. There you go.
I'm what? Not in a hospice?
You're not in a hospital with COVID. And that's,
well,
that's
I don't know.
Or worse.
I've got a son upstairs who's been exposed to it like an incredibly number of times. We're dodging, like the virus is flying around our faces up here, but we're dodging and ducking. So far, we're okay. But I don't, sooner or later, my wife and I are going to have COVID, no question.
Well,
but at least we got this meeting in before.
Get him on that vaccine list, Marco. Pull some strings here.
That's right. You know, I'm in the danger zone. I deserve a vaccine shot. Chairman, can you give me a
vaccine shot? You deserve something. I don't know that a vaccine shot is it.
Can you pull some strings, Chairman? You've got strings. Pull some strings and say, but now I need a vaccine in the worst possible way.
I'm trying to be charitable in the holiday season here.
Not for any other illnesses. Don't treat my other illnesses. Just the COVID, man.
I won't get into that.
Okay. All right.
Thank you so much for what you. I really want to echo my colleague's gratitude for a really good memo. And I want to thank my colleagues for a really good conversation today, too.
Yes.
Thank you.
All right, then. If nothing else, let's just conclude the meeting. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
All right.